Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and joining me this week, as ever, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And we're delighted to welcome from GB News, Patrick Christie.
Hey, thanks for having me, chaps.
Thanks very much for coming on.
Yeah.
We all want to feel our best, but there's so much conflicting advice out there about what our bodies need and don't need. It can feel almost impossible to take your health into your own hands without becoming an expert on diet and nutrition. I used to feel that way too, until I learned about AG1. AG1 is a daily nutrition supplement that makes it easy to live well. Just one scoop contains 70 high-quality ingredients, all designed to meet your baseline nutritional needs. Lately, I've been enjoying drinking AG1 with my morning coffee. It's so easy to incorporate into my daily routine. I just mix one scoop of AG1 powder with water. It takes less than a minute to give my body exactly what it needs to start the day. That's because AG1 contains a range of important vitamins and nutrients. For example, AG1 gives you the vitamin C and zinc you need to support your immune health, which is really important to keep those seasonal colds at bay. But for me, one of the most surprising benefits of AG1 is the effect it's had on my stress levels. I feel so much more alert, focused, and calm than I ever used to. AG1 has done wonders for my mood. The best part about AG1 is that I can trust it. It contains only the highest quality ingredients, and it adheres to the strictest manufacturing standards. This isn't snake oil. It really is that good for you. So if you want to take ownership of your health, try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/spiked. That's drinkag1.com/spiked. Check it out. So let's move on to talk about Scotland's pretty monstrously authoritarian hate crime act. Police Scotland have actually put out a video warning people that the act is going to come in on the 1st of April. Let's take a quick look at it.
The hate monster wants you to feel what you need to show. You're better than them. Then, before you know it, you've committed a hate crime.
So before you know it, Tom,
yeah,
you've already committed a hate crime. I mean, that's the sort of... how easy it will be to commit a hate crime in Scotland when basically most speech is outlawed.
No, completely. It's a lot easier than even the hate monster wants to lead you to believe. I love that. Like I don't love it. It's very telling, though, of the way in which the Scottish government relate to its public. Like they have to be told, like school children being told to look both ways before they cross the street by a friendly hedgehog. In the same way, they have to create the hate monster to explain to them that they shouldn't get carried away and start racially or religiously abusing people just because they feel like it. I mean, in some respects, I think that video sums it up perfectly. It is the fact that the SNP in particular have this remarkable contempt for their own public. You know, they want to free Scots from the yoke of English control and so on, but at the same time they don't trust those people to even run their own lives, to even wander down the street without being horrible to people, to even, you know, look after their kids effectively. The sort of meddling on kind of every level of society that they've introduced. And I think that the hate crime bill is just the most explicit and extreme version of that we've seen so far, insofar as the sweeping restrictions on speech. One thing that's come up this week as well, which is a reminder of just how broad and potentially tyrannical this piece of legislation is that the big scandal has been around Police Scotland's guidance, which has indicated that, contrary to reassurances from the Scottish National Party, that even the performances of plays will potentially be under the jurisdiction of all of this. It just speaks to not only the intolerance, the liberalism of this government, that much we knew, but that profound contempt for ordinary people, that everything from how they talk to each other to what kind of art and culture they might engage with has to be regulated by the state in this sense. Otherwise, all hell will break loose.
Yeah. And the new offence that's created is around so-called stirring up hatred, but it's never really actually defined in the law, so it has been left up to the police to come up with their own guidance. And, you know, various, like, ex-top coppers have said this is just all hell is going to break loose when this law comes in. I mean, not just performers. I mean, think of what the Edinburgh Fringe is going to be like. But, you know, J.K. Rowling has come out and said, you know what, I'm going to carry on speaking. Come after me.
Yeah.
And there was even some police training where they held an event around the Hate Crime Act, and they invented a fictional character called Joe, who believes that there are only two biological sexes, and who
has certain views about trans people. And, you know, they ask people, do you think this is a hate crime, etc. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, what do you think would be the reaction if, say, J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author, were dragged out of her house one day in handcuffs?
Yeah, I think potentially it is possible. There's nothing... I've been watching that video, by the way. It's the first time I've seen it. I mean, the idea that the Scottish people, the Scottish government, think that it's all right to talk to people about the hate monster. I mean, it does look a little bit like a cock sock with lizard eyes, doesn't it? I mean, that's what they've decided to go for there. It's remarkable. I just think when you look at the people who are defining what hate is as well, and what is hateful content, right? And a lot of the time, like the people in the top brass of the SNP, they are just frothing hypocrites themselves about the way that they live their lives and about the things they do. I mean, the Nicola Sturgeon scandal that's going on at the moment, you know, with the old motorhome issues and all of that kind of stuff. You know, huge question marks there over her credibility, really, as an upstanding member of society, let alone a good political leader. You've also got Humza Yousaf. I think when he was transport minister, it was fined, I think, for driving without a seatbelt, which, all right, it's not the biggest crime in the world, but there's a lot of stuff to do with that. I think he was absent on one of the trans votes as well. And everyone then went after his opponent in the SNP race because she just said something which was, I thought, quite reasonable, which is, look, I'm not looking to overturn or do anything here, but just with my personal religious interpretation of the Christian views that she personally has, she wasn't in favour of it, which I think is perfectly fair enough. That's her view. She's not really actually looking to change anybody's life over it. He skipped that vote, and there was no pressure put on him as to why that happened. So, yeah, who are these people that get to define what hateful content is and what the rules are? You know, I just don't trust them. Mm-hmm. I don't trust their ability to do that.
And that is sort of fundamentally the flaw with all hate speech legislation, because at the end of the day, it's the powers that be that decide, you know, they can have a completely different interpretation of what's hateful than you or I.
Mm-hmm. And especially where the gender issue comes into this has been a really clear example of how if you allow someone in a position of authority to decide what is and isn't hateful, you're very quickly going to get into a situation in which something which isn't hateful by any stretch of the imagination, by any kind of majority common sense position, is going to be deemed as such, because these things are ultimately subjective. We might all think we know it when we see it, but this is not something that you can pin down in law. And it's also something that you shouldn't try and pin down in law, because even when you're dealing with genuine bigotry, hatred, the sort of which the vast majority of people can agree in terms of opposing, you don't solve that problem by criminalizing those people. That's obvious. The problem that we have now is that the kind of views that are in the crosshairs are views that are held by easily a majority of, say, the Scottish people, the British people. The fact that gender has become a key battleground in this is because we effectively have an elite trying to criminalize a majority opinion, which is that there are only two sexes. Also happens to be objective fact. And this is the road that we're being led down. Incidentally, in terms of the legislation itself, if you read through the guidance that the government have put out, first of all, they want, the police have said that they will investigate all claims made against it, which is interesting because they've also taken famously a proportionate approach to other criminal activities. So whilst they might not attend a burglary, if you say someone's misgendered me on the internet, they're going to be right on that as soon as possible. And this is just going to be an invitation to vexatious claims. Yeah. That's obvious. The fact everyone knows, anyone who's even casually observed the sort of gender wars knows that trans activists have attempted to weaponize the law, even existing laws, against their opponents constantly. So the fact that they're just basically giving a green light to all of that suggests that this is going to be a real mess as it goes forward.
I actually think it's legitimizing hate, right? But hate from the very people who claim to be the victims of a lot of this stuff. So, you know, if you say, oh, so-and-so's tweet was hate speech. Let's just take the trans example. The J.K. Rowling, she's a great example of this, okay? If you characterise that individual for her views, which, by the way, happen to be completely mainstream and, as you said, grounded in total biological fact, as hateful, then you actually legitimise, I would argue, the potential for some quite violent action towards that person as well, because people on the street, they will see her as lesser than, as being evil, as being vile, and therefore that then means that you've got carte blanche to go and do whatever you like to that person. The other aspect of this for me is, what are they so scared of? You know, if these views are out there, why are you so scared of hearing them, other people hearing them, debating them, that you essentially have to cancel them and criminalise them? I find that remarkable. The sort of thing in America they probably still do, don't they, called swatting, where someone would think it was funny to call up, say that something was going on at someone's house and the armed police kick the door in. I mean, how far off are we from someone tweeting something and the hate police smash the window in and they're round? And we are, you mentioned there about other proper serious crimes. You know, we are very, very bad in this country at doing things like getting rape convictions, for example, you know, very serious crimes. And what can the possible justification be for police investigating every single report of a hate crime when you have, you know, countless women in this country who don't feel safe to walk the streets? I find it astonishing that they would decide to, you know, devote their time and energy to that, really.
It is extraordinary. I mean, another factor in this is that you can report these crimes anonymously, not necessarily to the police. And so there are various third-party places that have been assigned as sort of hate crime hubs. Some of them include a mushroom farm in East Lothian and a sex shop in Glasgow. So, you know, going to purchase your sex toys and report a hate crime at the same time. And expect a police response, shockingly.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
I just love that. Can I do anything else for you today? Yeah. Well, yeah. On the way here.
I was misgendered.
Yeah, remote. Just what do you think? It couldn't get any more like beyond parody.
Absolutely.
You know, it really is. And they've got enough to worry about in Scotland. You know, there's issues with the NHS, issues with the education system, issues with the numpty they've got leading them, all of this stuff. And you know,
whose fingerprints are all over this bill, incidentally, because obviously he was the one who
heralded
it. Yeah, originally speaking, and was really defending it very fiercely. And it is worth, so I think two things are important to underline here, one of which is just how deeply authoritarian the SNP have revealed themselves to be, because it's not just this piece of legislation. It's not even just some of the nanny state stuff which we've written about on Spiked. If you think about their crackdown on offensive football chants, that was one of the first things they were doing as soon as they got into power. They of course wanted and thankfully failed to introduce the name person scheme, where every child would have to be assigned a kind of state guardian because they didn't trust their parents to bring them up and so on. And now this, it's really quite chilling. This is something that's obviously in the DNA of this party, which is not to, funnily enough, trust Scottish citizens to run their own lives. But I think it is also worth remembering that this is really building on kind of hate speech legislation nationwide, or also restrictions that we have in England against things like stirring up hatred in other forms. So this isn't as new and alien as it might seem, even if they are taking it that one step further.
I'm worried about, because Humza Yousaf at one point, as far as I can recall, was quite keen on the idea of criminalising speech within your own home as well, which is...
That is part of the bill.
Yeah. So, but that is especially mental, okay? Because what happens is, you know, you've got Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
Nan's round. Nan's got some views, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, the third generation who's round at that table, who's been through an incredibly woke and bubble-wrapped education system, is absolutely appalled. And before you know it, you know, Nan's in handcuffs and being let out.
She's been stirring up hatred at the dinner table.
And the only witnesses to that are the other members of your family. And boom, it rips families apart, which comes back to the destruction of the nuclear family. You're welcome. It's serious. It's ridiculous. You can't speak freely in your own home, for goodness sake. It's bonkers.
Terrifying. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is a bit like leaving your keys in the ignition in a car park. I mean, your car might not get stolen, but do you really want to take the risk? This is basically what happens every time you connect to an unencrypted network. When you use the Wi-Fi in cafes, hotels, or airports, anyone on the same network can gain access to all of your data. You're pretty much handing over your passwords, financial details, and personal information to hackers, who can then sell it all on the dark web. That's why I use ExpressVPN when I'm online. ExpressVPN creates a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the Wi-Fi network. That means hackers don't stand a chance. Even using the most high-tech supercomputer, it would take them over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's super strong encryption. Don't worry if all of this sounds complicated. ExpressVPN is actually really easy to use. All you have to do is open the app, press one button, and that's it. Your data is protected. Plus, it works on all your devices, phones, laptops, tablets. So with ExpressVPN, you can stay safe wherever you are. As you probably already know, Spiked cares a lot about internet freedom and fighting back against big tech. And here's one way you can keep noisy corporations out of your private life. Personally, I don't browse the internet without ExpressVPN anymore. Once I learned how vulnerable we all are to data breaches and being hacked, I just couldn't risk it. And ExpressVPN is by far the simplest and quickest VPN I've ever used. So, secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/spiked. That's expressvpn.com/spiked. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. That's expressvpn.com/spiked.
spiked.
So let's talk about Ireland's Leo Varadkar. He has resigned. He's citing political and personal reasons. Tom, I think the most obvious and proximate cause is the humiliating dual referendum defeat not that long ago. Mm-hmm. Do you think? I think that's probably the...
Well, I definitely. I mean, it was easy at the time to gloss over just what a profound sort of challenge to the whole Irish establishment, really, that vote was, because they all lined up behind both of those referendum questions and urged everyone to vote yes. And the fact that they were so emphatically defeated, I think, was something that was always going to cause questions to be asked about his particular leadership. At the time, he said he was going to carry on. He tried to make a virtue out of the fact that we all backed it. So, so it can't be a repudiation of us specifically, but obviously that was something which dealt a big blow to him. And whilst he claims that it's a kind of mix of personal and political reasons, it's hard to rule that out. I think referenda, as we talked a bit about on the podcast last week, have become a fantastic way of just demonstrating how profoundly out of touch politicians are, because they keep either calling them, thinking that everyone will agree with them on it, or they keep begrudgingly offering one on an issue of public importance, Brexit, etc., and then realising that the public not only just narrowly disagree with them, but really disagree with them on these questions. So it's you can't separate out those two things, but he's hardly had a wonderful time at the top of Irish politics, you know, and this he wasn't an overwhelmingly popular T-shirt by any stretch of the imagination, but you can't help but feel this was the thing that finally pushed him out, because it just showed how distant he was from the people he was supposed to be governing on behalf of.
Yeah, Patrick?
I can't help but wonder what else is about to come out about Leo Varadkar, but obviously we'll have to wait. The key point for me is touching on what you just said there, really, which is that if you actually really think about a lot of the core things that are affecting people's day-to-day lives at the moment, whether or not that's, you know, national sovereignty with Brexit, whether it's the net zero stuff, whether it would be with things like mass immigration or illegal immigration, or things like the trans issue that we've spoken about there, and a variety of those different things. I am pretty convinced that we would know how the vast majority of the public would vote on all of those issues. And you have to look at how radically different a lot of our politicians feel about them and the policies that they want to bat through. And then when they do put them to the public, you know, they tend to get a kicking. My concern is, though, that in the wake of Brexit and in the wake of this Leo Varadkar issue that we've got now, you know, we might never really have a referendum again. Mm. And you look at the next kind of referendum that we've got, with the general election, I would say. What are you voting for there? I mean, it's one area, genuinely, I don't say this very often, it is an area where I do agree with George Galloway on. You know, it's two cheeks of the same backside. What are we voting on? So, you know, the only time you can be trusted to make a choice is between essentially two people that you hate and don't offer you anything.
And the fact, the way that the Irish political class all lined up to every, you know, every single party behind, you know, those two particular referendums is a good illustration of that kind of problem. I mean, Tom, talking about Varadkar specifically, I mean, he is known for a couple of quite dodgy things, thinking about Irish hate speech laws, probably even worse than the Scottish ones we were just talking about. I mean, he's seen as a sort of very woke leader. Migration has become a massive issue in Ireland in the way that it wasn't previously. And he recently said that St. Patrick was a male, single, undocumented migrant, as if that were some sort of persuasive argument.
No, absolutely. I mean, the politics of immigration in Ireland seems so acute, like much more so than even here. Obviously, there were those riots in Dublin at the tail end of last year, which had been very keenly kind of used to try and discredit the quite widespread discontent with the influx of not only asylum seekers, but also economic migrants into the country. But it's quite clear that that's not just a fringe criminal concern. That's something that voters across the political spectrum are really concerned about. And it's another issue, not unlike the family and care referendums recently, where basically the entire Irish political class, including the supposedly insurgent Sinn Féin party, all agree on. Absolutely. If anything, there was some interesting polling suggesting that Sinn Féin voters are more anti-immigration than your average, incidentally, despite the fact the political leadership there are certainly not of that particular ilk. So it's just on issue after issue, you have not just Leo Varadkar, not just Fine Gael, but like the entire Irish political establishment being on the wrong side of the voters. And that's going to come to a head at some point. I mean, if it's going to continue to manifest itself in kind of protests and whatnot, but it'll be interesting to see what the political electoral consequences of all this are going to be.
Definitely. And Patrick, just lots of British viewers will probably think of Varadkar as one of the many frustrators of Brexit. He played a sort of outside role in that.
Yeah, well, again, absolutely. And that chap there decided that he wanted to massively cozy up with Brussels, obviously loved the huge amount of backslapping that he got any time that he was with his European friends. Like, couldn't run his own home, clearly, quite literally, because he's resigned probably before he was pushed. But, I mean, there's, you know, the issues with the border, for example, cozying up to Joe Biden, who, I mean, I don't know whether it's Joe Biden or his carers, but one of them or all of them hate us, clearly. So you've had that thing. Threatening to take us to the ECHR over things like historic prosecutions, over the Troubles, etc. I did find that, you know, quite astonishing, really. But I think, again, one of the key points is that I think he massively, massively underestimated actually how patriotic the Irish people are. And when they were really backed into a corner over massive immigration levels, higher per capita, I believe, than we've got over here, huge issues as well with things like migrant hotels, for example. That's mainly, I think, because you can hide a lot of migrant hotels here in like big cities in Britain, because it all blends in, you know, big multicultural cities, etc. Ireland, you know, is actually very, very dispersed. If you do plant one, you know, in the middle of nowhere, it has a disproportionate impact on that local community. They were more inclined to rise up about that. There is more, I think, overt pride in the national flag of Ireland than there is even here in Britain. And I think he massively underestimated that. And ultimately, it's all very well and good cozying up to Brussels and trying to engage in gimmicky political style things like we've just discussed. But if you just completely desecrate and ignore your base, the people who actually do vote for you, who, quotes unquote, pay your wages, then, you know, you end up in a situation like this. I don't think history is going to remember him particularly well. The only thing that might benefit him is that history will probably be taught in schools by incredibly woke teachers who will indeed remember him well.
And finally, Tom, I mean, can we put Varadkar in that sort of vein of almost liberal or woke authoritarian leader? Mm. You know, I'm thinking like he reminds me of a sort of Trudeau figure or a Jacinda figure or a Sturgeon figure.
It does certainly seem that kind of centrist political figures seem to reach for woke authoritarianism as a way to sort of carve out a legacy. I mean, they would see it, and you saw this in his resignation speech, see it as part of a project of kind of liberalising their respective nations, or kind of bringing them into the 21st century. You know, he name-checked the abortion referendum. And in a weird sort of way, I think they think these outrageous authoritarian impositions, like the hate crime bill that they've been mooting for a long time, are like an extension of that, when they're completely different. One's about freedom, one is about limiting freedom. But nevertheless, I think there is that sense that the more that you have politicians who don't really have much of a kind of vision, the more they kind of reach for these kinds of policies, these kinds of laws, these kinds of measures, because for whatever reason, they're seen on the kind of international stage as progressive, interesting, righteous things to do. So in pursuit of a legacy, they end up doing some quite horrendous authoritarian things, it ends up being.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We're back every Friday, and you can now watch us on video too. Check us out on YouTube or go via the Spiked website, which is spiked-online.com. See you next time.